the fifth kind.
Religion, mythology, superstition, legend, belief, however you categorize all this vast body of knowledge that we have, there's no getting away from the fact that many, many different accounts from different cultures all around the world have talked about interaction between what are portrayed as gods or devils or angels or demons and people. And so those interactions are a constant theme. The idea of gods coming from the sky, but sometimes from under the water too, is again a feature. And the idea of people being, I'll use the phrase, sort of forcibly taken by the gods up into the skies. There was no question bigger or more profound than, are we alone or not in the universe? And might we be visited? And you could call it, even if you're skeptical about it, you could view it, as we did in the Ministry of Defense, as the ultimate low probability, high impact scenario. In other words, even if you think the possibility of this is vanishingly small, it's not zero. And that being the case, one has to think, what would be the consequences if any of these cases, if just one of these cases out of all the tens and thousands over the years turned out to be extraterrestrial?
Nick Pope is one of the world's leading authorities on the UFO phenomenon. For more than 20 years, he worked for the British Ministry of Defense, investigating case studies of UFO sightings and engagements, and examining their implications for national security. He is the author of 6 best-selling books, including The Uninvited, Open Skies and Closed Minds, and Encounter in Rendlesham Forest. Nick Pope, welcome to Fifth Kind TV.
Thank you. It's good to be on the show.
Fifth Kind.
Thanks so much for joining us today. It's a great pleasure speaking with you. And I want to begin by acknowledging my personal debt to you, because I really became aware of you 10, 11, 12 years ago. And at that time, I was really in the thick of Christian ministry. And though I had some awareness of the possibility that we might be living in a populated universe, I really didn't have much room in my theology at that time for UFO phenomena or ET contact or anything like that. And then one day, I think it was quite by accident, I think my wife Ruth and I had just watched all the romantic comedies there were in the DVD store, and I found a documentary featuring you. And you really confronted me with some data that I had not seen before, that I had not had to process before. And you forced me back to my drawing board to think again about the world we're living in. So thank you so much for doing that for me.
Well, thank you for that. I certainly don't see it as my role to tell people what to think. But I think it is my role to maybe challenge people and put some information out there. Then people can check it out for themselves, check it back to the source, and then come to their own views. But I think this is a subject where there's a lot of, I don't know, misinformation, disinformation, call it what you like, out there, particularly on the internet. A lot of people may be confronted by this who are not sure about the source material. And if I can bring a little bit of this to the table and say, well, look, there's some good information out there, particularly sourced from, say, the government, military cases, instances where people have tracked things on radar. So cases where you've got more than just hearsay, and those are the cases that I think do challenge people, challenge their worldview, challenge them to take another look at the phenomenon, put aside the sorts of talk of little green men and flying saucers that sometimes just cause people to roll their eyes and not give this much thought, and say, well, wait a minute, there is a serious body of data here. Let's take a look at it.
Exactly. And that is what I found so helpful about your approach, and what I like so much about your approach. You're not someone who's jumping up and down, waving red flags, saying, come on, everybody, it's aliens. But you do direct our attention to data that is well worth our attention and worth our reflecting on. And that's really what you did for me. Your grounded approach made it possible for me to start doing business with some of this data. And I think taking that grounded approach really invites more people into the conversation. I'm sure you've had an incredibly busy last couple of years with all that's in the news. And we're going to get into some of that as we talk today, talk a little bit about Hamish Shedd and his recent statement, Chris Mellon, Luis Elizondo, Alain Juillet, and some others who've been in the news just lately. But before we get into that, I'd love to go back to that time just before I was beginning to get to know you virtually, so to speak. And that was the time when you were transitioning from your career with Ministry of Defence into the work that's followed, because you had worked for Ministry of Defence assessing UFO claims, assessing their implications for national security. What was it about that work that meant that when you retired from that, you stayed in the same broad arena and have stayed motivated in this field ever since? Can you share a bit of that journey with us?
Sure. And I should begin by just clarifying that my time in the Ministry of Defence, I worked there for 21 years. The time that I was investigating UFOs was one posting in that wider 21-year career. So I did plenty of other things. Over the years, I've had jobs to do with financial policy, personnel policy. My final tour of duty was as an acting deputy director in the Directorate of Defense Security. I know that's a bit of a mouthful, but obviously things like counterterrorism was at the heart of that. So in my time, I've done many, many different jobs for the Ministry of Defense. But this was the one, the UFO job, of course, I think was the one that really stuck out, because in my mind, there was no question bigger or more profound than, are we alone or not in the universe? And might we be visited? And you could call it, even if you're skeptical about it, you could view it as we did in the Ministry of Defense, as the ultimate low probability, high impact scenario. In other words, even if you think the possibility of this is vanishingly small, it's not zero. And that being the case, one has to think, what would be the consequences if any of these cases, if just one of these cases out of all the tens and thousands over the years turned out to be extraterrestrial? This would be something with game-changing implications for every aspect of our lives, politics, religion, economics, science, technology, philosophy, personal paradigm, you name it, the list goes on. So to me, it was just too interesting and too important to walk away from. And when I took early retirement from the Ministry of Defense in 2006, I was already fortunate enough to be in a position where I'd done some writing and some television work. Obviously, there were constraints on what I could do and say. I'm still bound by the Official Secrets Act, by the way. That binds me for life. But inevitably, I'm a little bit more free to speculate and to maybe get into some of the interesting areas with this. So I increasingly found myself doing journalism, writing for various national daily newspapers, appearing on TV news programs, documentaries, and also, which is great fun, interesting but great fun too, advising, working with film and TV companies in a consultancy role. So I don't have to tell you how many alien and UFO-themed movies and TV shows there are out there. And I often get called in to work behind the scenes on these sorts of shows, just to bring a little bit of realism. The start point is often, well, how would the government, how would the military really respond if something like that happened? And very often, as I say, I'm working behind the scenes on that, which is interesting. So I was able to step quite easily from one career to another. And I don't get me wrong, I absolutely loved my time working for the Ministry of Defense, both on the UFO program, but all the other things as well. Security and counterterrorism, where I ended up, obviously interesting and important too. So I had mixed feelings about walking away from that, but I just felt after 21 years, it was time for a fresh challenge. And I'm glad I made the move. And of course, in a few years after that, I met Elizabeth and we got married and I moved to the US anyway. So I would have, if I wanted to move to the US, I would have had to have left the MOD anyway.
That's great. And I can quite understand what you say. If you had the choice of continuing in this field or finding something else in finances and procurements, I would choose this field as well. It's been such an interesting time in this field in the last few years. Just in the last few days, we've heard from Haim Ashed, the former chief of Israel's space security program, talking about a galactic federation being already in contact, but choosing a policy of non-disclosure. What's your comment on that? What's the significance of that statement and who it is that's bringing that claim?
It's staggering. It's absolutely staggering. When I was first contacted about this, I think a journalist from NBC reached out to me and said, what do you think? And I was like, my goodness, I mean, is this some sort of practical joke that's got out of hand, or is some sort of publicity stunt for a book? But the more I looked at it, I mean, the more I began to think, well, wait a minute, here is somebody of absolutely impeccable credentials speaking out about this. And it's at first it sounds just almost too crazy to entertain. I mean, this is almost every sci-fi cliche about alien life. Secret underground bases on Mars, Galactic Federation, President Trump about to disclose, but talked out of it at the last moment because of fear that there'd be global panic. I mean, if this was coming from almost anyone else, you would just dismiss it out of hand. But this guy is who he says he is. He did what he said he did. And even though they've made it clear that they disagree with him, many of his colleagues in Israel, in government, in the space program, have spoken out to say this is a highly credentialed, respected national hero, a scientist, somebody who's now a professor of astronautics and aeronautics. He's mentioned on the Smithsonian website as one of the true pioneers of really the whole space race, I suppose you'd say, or space industry. As you say, co-founded Israel's space program, instrumental in launching Israel's first satellite. My only question then becomes, is he speaking about this as something that he believes, i.e. something that somebody else has told him and resonates with him, or is he speaking about something he knows? And now, this very often in my Ministry of Defense work, when I was briefing, you were always told from day one, you know certain things, and then you can go on to analyze and assess and come out with an opinion. But you must make it abundantly clear when you transition from what you know to what you think. So my only question, I suppose, with all of this is where on that spectrum is Haim Ashed? Is this opinion through reading literature, through perhaps having been told things by other people, or is it direct first-hand knowledge through personal experience of being on the inside of some of this? And those questions we don't yet have definitive answers to. Lots of people are obviously pushing away at this story, still trying to find that out. And all I can say is there are obviously still some missing pieces of the puzzle here. But my goodness, how interesting that we're even having this debate. Because when people like this come out and say these sorts of things, whether you believe it or not, it's worthy of our attention. And of course, mainstream media journalists with beats on space and intelligence and government matters are looking at this, and rightly so.
It is staggering, and it's staggering because of who's saying it. It's so different from the world I grew up in, when if you were talking about UFOs, you would hear reports coming from the public, and very often it would be accounts that would be easily debunked, and the authorities would be doing the debunking. But here is an authoritative figure talking not only just about a UFO phenomenon, but talking about covert contact. On the one hand, it's staggering in that way. On the other hand, Ed Mitchell, for years and years, the sixth man to walk on the moon, former Apollo astronaut, campaigned for disclosure, declassification of the USA's files on the UFO phenomenon. And he spoke. He didn't use the exact same language of an intergalactic federation, but he did assert that there is a multiple ET presence, that we ought to be taking our place as one of a number of spacefaring civilizations. That was his language. So I'd sort of heard this kind of language before from him, and he always spoke as if this was known but not disclosed, and he wanted it disclosed. And now we have somebody, quite an authoritative figure, using very similar language. So my ears really pricked up when I heard this. So I'm really intrigued to see where this goes and what happens when we drill down into why is he saying this? What are his sources? Is he going to make another statement to give us a bit more background to it? He's one of a number of people who are sort of one degree removed, if I can put it that way, from the person in the job making a statement. And so another perhaps would be Chris Mellon, the former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Presidents Clinton and George W. Bush. And he's spoken really about the Pentagon's involvement in the UFO phenomenon. He has put it out there that he wanted the Senate Intelligence Committee to pursue this. And now it looks like we're getting some action on that front. Could you make some comments on that?
Certainly. Well, Christopher Mellon has been deeply involved with this subject over the last few years, working. He's done one or two very public things, of course, in terms of some television interviews and a couple of op-eds. But of course, he's been working away very diligently behind the scenes with various congressional people, various senators, staffers, etc. I don't think it's disputed. In fact, it's absolutely not, because a number of senators have confirmed they've actually received this. But there have been classified briefings going on in Congress, both in the Senate and the House. The Armed Services Committee has been involved. The Intelligence Committee has been involved. And as you say, the one of the very interesting aspects of all of this is what happened with the Senate Intelligence Committee, because when earlier this year the Intelligence Authorization Act for fiscal year 2021 was drafted, into it went some language and some paragraphs about UFOs, asking that DNI, Director of National Intelligence, draw together a report on all this. And this has now been rolled into the the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, which, as I speak, is on President Trump's desk. It's been sent to him. It's been passed by both houses in Congress. He's threatening to veto it for a number of reasons totally unconnected with UFOs. Social media companies, military bases named after Confederate figures, those are the sorts of things. Now, President Trump has occasionally previously threatened to veto things just to maybe leverage a few more concessions, and hasn't actually gone through with it. So we'll see what happens. But as things stand, in the Act as currently drafted is this requirement that Director of National Intelligence produce a full report on UFOs. So we'll see what happens.
Now, you mentioned Donald Trump there. He was filmed earlier this year in conversation with his son-in-law. And in that conversation, it seemed he was saying that he might have some interesting, privileged, maybe classified material regarding the Roswell incident. And his son-in-law was asking if he would consider declassifying that. And he said, well, I know some interesting things. I'd have to think about it. And he brushed it off that way. What do you make of that? What information could Donald Trump have that would possibly be interesting about Roswell after all these years?
Well, this is where I probably part company with some people in the UFO community. I think sometimes you hear people in the UFO communities or list various presidents and then say, oh, this president knew about UFOs and the alien presence. This one didn't. They run through a list and they usually say, well, Bush Senior was told because of CIA background, but Clinton wasn't told. And I don't hold with any of that. If there's an extraterrestrial presence, every single president would have to be told because they would need to know it in their role as commander in chief. In government, you have something called the culture of no surprises. And essentially, you have to ensure that political leadership is briefed on any big strategic decision on which they might have to make pretty much instantaneous and strategically vital decisions. So simply put, you couldn't have a situation where the chairman of the Joint Chiefs burst into the Oval Office and said, Mr. President, situation with the aliens has deteriorated. We need to take some urgent action, only for the president to look quizzically back and say, what aliens? So to me, it's obvious. And I've actually briefed incoming, an incoming prime minister, not on the UFO issue, but on a range of other issues that I was handling with the MOD at the time. And I know what the process is. And so to answer your question, if there's an alien presence, Trump would have been told about that on day one, probably before day one, actually, the moment after the election and before the inauguration. So started with Roswell.
Yes. So what interesting information would Trump have about Roswell?
Well, it would be everything. Look, you couldn't dip in and selectively give the president a briefing that there's an alien presence and not give the backstory. And if we're assuming that all this is true, Roswell is the backstory. Roswell is probably where it all started and when we learned that there was this extraterrestrial visitation presence, whatever you term it. So you wouldn't just cherry pick it. You would have to say, well, this is how it came about, and if that means wreckage as part of that, or even something more intact, then so be it. But look, President Trump's remarks to his son-in-law weren't given in isolation. He gave an ABC News interview where he confirmed that he had certainly been to a meeting on all this. He gave an interview to Tucker Carlson at Fox News about this. He wrapped up a briefing to Reuters by saying about one of those three Navy videos that we've seen of the UFO chasing, the Navy jets chasing UFOs. He wrapped up a briefing by saying that's one heck of a video and who knows, maybe it's real. And then, of course, to pick a different president, just a couple of weeks ago, former President Obama went on to The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. And Colbert said, did you ask about UFOs? And Obama said, yes, I asked. And Colbert said, what was the answer? What's the deal with it? And he said, I can't tell you. Yes. And so Colbert said, well, you've kind of given the game away, haven't you? Because if there was nothing to tell, you would have said, but your your sort of I can't tell you speaks volumes. And it's amazing when you go back and look at presidents, whether it's Bush or Clinton or whoever it is, and talking often to comedians like Jimmy Kimmel, for example, they often kind of give a similar line, and it makes one wonder.
Yes. Do you think there's been a shift in what is being said publicly by authorities? Are we being, you know, a degree more informed by the way people are responding right now?
There's been a seismic shift. Yes, absolutely. 3 years ago, if you as a journalist or broadcaster had contacted the public affairs office at the Pentagon and said, what's your line on UFOs, please, doing a story, they would have said no one's interested and no one's investigating. And then on December 16th, 2017, New York Times ran this story, of course, and said, well, actually, despite the denials, there is a program. It's called ATIP, Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program. And they looked at this phenomenon, and they have some videos of U.S. Navy jets chasing UFOs. And of course, the Times, and I've written for the Times, the fact checking that they do is phenomenal. And of course, yes, they're not just listening to people and letting them tell their stories. They're saying, okay, where's the evidence for this? So they speak to Luis Elizondo as the intelligence official who was running this program. They speak to David Fravor as one of the pilots who was involved in chasing. They speak to other people who don't go on the record, but who confirm that this is legitimate. And finally, of course, most importantly, they reach out to the Pentagon itself and say, well, come on, if you want to shoot down this story, just tell us it's all wrong, and of course we're not going to run it. And of course they can't, they don't. And they confirm, yes, we had a program. Now they try to put their spin on it, of course, and say, well, you know, the implication with all of this is that it was looking at advanced aerospace threats from Russia and China. But we can get into all sorts of reasons for, you know, showing that that's not true. So the rest is history. That story ran, and it was closely followed by Washington Post, Politico, The Hill, ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, CNN, the list goes on. And this subject, as I like to say, with that story came out of the fringe and into the mainstream, and it was followed by revelation after revelation after revelation. The congressional interest, the Navy issuing guidance to its pilots on what to do if they encounter these things, confirmation that they did indeed investigate what they call UAP, Unidentified Aerial Phenomena, which is the term we popularized in the Ministry of Defense for this in the 90s, the comments by President Trump, the Senate Intelligence Committee interest, the fact that there have been senators going on the record saying, I have been briefed, and obviously they were shocked enough about what they were told to put this request for a proper investigation and a proper report into the Intelligence Authorization Act. So we are in this now, as you and I discussed this, 3 years after the Times ran that landmark story, we are in a fundamentally changed landscape with this subject.
Yes, I agree. I saw an interview when you said that you didn't actually want to get into this originally. It wasn't something that interested you. I'm guessing that's changed now since you've started investigating it as deep as you have, and the people you meet. I know you mentioned Barbara Lam and John Mack and other people such as this that you've spoke to. What do you take away from some of their experiences that they talk about? Do you think that there's a presence that is coming and taking people away, and that could be connected to the UFO sightings that we do see?
Well, I certainly don't rule that out. And just to go back to where you came in with that point, yes, when I first got involved with this subject, I didn't have any particular knowledge, interest, or belief in it. To me, this was just another Ministry of Defense assignment. And in fact, although I intuitively grasped Well, I suppose it's common sense, really, that of course it was going to be interesting. It wasn't necessarily my first choice of what I wanted to do. I was at the junior executive grade, and all us junior executives, of course, wanted to get on and up as quickly as possible. And we all had our eyes on the real plum jobs, most of which were things like working in the office of the Secretary of State. Even if you were only managing the diary or the parliamentary schedule, those were the jobs you wanted, because those were the ones that would get you noticed by the sort of senior players in the Ministry of Defence. So when I was given the UFO job, it was a little bit, we'll see where I go with this. But obviously, the more I did that, the more I got drawn in. And I did get promoted after 3 years doing that, so I must have been doing something right. But yes, in relation to John Mack and Barbara Lamb and I suppose the whole alien abduction phenomenon, as I say, I don't know what we're dealing with there, but again, we have a vast body of testimony on this, and people say, well, it's not as well evidenced as the UFO sightings, where we have things like forward-looking infrared camera footage, radar data, other MASINT data, measurement and signature intelligence. But we should never ignore eyewitness testimony. Eyewitness testimony still in this era of closed-circuit television and forensics, eyewitness testimony still lies at the heart of our criminal justice system. And people are acquitted or convicted every day on the basis of eyewitness testimony and in the basis of a jury evaluating that eyewitness testimony and the stories, the testimony of the witnesses, and juries asking themselves, assessing afterwards, does this sound credible? And as I say, people every day all around the world are either convicted or acquitted on the basis of that. So the point is, and I knew John Mack quite well, and this was a point he often made, it is ill-advised to just throw something out because you've only got eyewitness testimony for it. So that's where I stand with the abduction phenomenon. Of course, as I said in the intro, it's much more difficult to prove because we don't have things like radar data or MASINT data or FLIR data. And so it's going to be much more difficult to bring in the sorts of defense and intelligence journalists in the media who are now beginning to pay serious attention to the UFO subject. I don't think they're quite going to touch the abduction side of this yet. Although it's interesting because if you look at the letter that the Defense Intelligence Agency sent Congress shortly after the New York Times broke the story about ATIP, they list 38 technical studies that were done under the ATIP contract. And if you read between the lines of one of the titles, they were certainly looking at the sort of human experience and human effect of this. And we looked at similar things in the Ministry of Defense in an intelligence assessment codenamed Project Condyne, where we looked at what we called UAP radiation and human interface. So there are some clues out there. And we know that some of the people who have been working on the ATIP contract, and I'm talking about some of the Bigelow Aerospace people and some of the people associated with that work, have gotten into the business, for example, of looking at blood samples and DNA samples from close encounter witnesses. Now, this is a very ethically and maybe even legally challenging aspect of all this, but it's out there, and at some point we are going to have to get into that.
Nick, in your work with Ministry of Defense, was there much of a crossover in this area? Did you do much work assessing case studies that involved what was called human interface?
Very limited, simply because the people were much more reluctant to come forward. I think it's one thing to report a UFO. It's quite another thing to to report an alien abduction, particularly to an organization that you actually think is involved at some level in the cover-up.
We were talking earlier about the New York Times breaking the story back in 2017, and you said how diligent the New York Times is in its fact-checking. Was that an official or a semi-official leak that got the story broken in the New York Times? I know the Pentagon came in later and confirmed the story, but the material that the New York Times had obviously came from a very credible authority.
I don't think it would be appropriate for me to really comment on whether any of this is an official leak. I think talking in generic terms, and one could say this with the New York Times article, one could say it in relation to a very recent article that appeared in The Debrief, where it certainly said that there were two or three people who had spoken to journalists at The Debrief who were serving members of the U.S. intelligence community. I think with all of this, one wonders, of course, you know, you might say, well, is this a leak or is it an authorized disclosure? I mean, very often, particularly in the shadowy world of intelligence, somebody will be authorized to, I won't say leak, but disclose, but maybe it looks like a leak, something because you want it out there. And yeah. I mean, not just in relation to UFOs, but in relation to all sorts of subjects, all sorts of subjects. I mean, sometimes the point is that you do for political ends. I mean, you know, geopolitical ends, strategic concerns. You want to get a particular story out in front of the media, in front of the public, sometimes to build a groundswell of opinion, or sometimes to send a message to, say, Russia or China. So sometimes, and one wonders with a lot of this, of course, are we dealing with people breaking ranks and speaking out because they disagree with policy, or are we dealing with people who have been told, go and get that information out in some of these publications because we want it out for some reason? As I say, I'm not really going to go too far down the road of speculating whether that's true with any of these UFO stories, but of course, I'm sure people are wondering and asking, and again, it's a legitimate question.
Exactly. When we hear respected physicists like Jacques Vallée speaking on the work he's doing in researching what he would call metamaterials, or the physicist Eric Davis briefing groups about off-world vehicles not made on this Earth, that language is really intriguing. It's a very specific form of words, and some would say, well, all that's really being disclosed there is that someone has engineered these materials in a zero-G environment. I think that's the technical aspect of it. Is that all that's being said? Are we saying, are we examining things, could be Chinese, could be Russian, or is that language tantamount to confessing that there is ET technology that we're looking at?
Well, I think the language is almost unequivocal in taking you down the road towards the extraterrestrial hypothesis. And of course, some of the people involved in these sorts of programs, they try and dress it up with a degree of respectability so it doesn't sound too crazy. And if you can allow me to diverge for a moment, I mean, just look at the comments. Is it John Brennan, former CIA head, made a couple of days ago about this? And my goodness, he uses the word might and could, I think, three times in the same sentence just to cover himself, but then ends up talking about different forms of life. So again, yeah, I think these sorts of officials have a sort of way of putting this so that they don't come straight out and say it's aliens. But yes. I think it's pretty clear what they mean. Now, the question arises with somebody like Eric Davis, of course. Is this an official view? Or is it simply the view of a contractor who worked on this program, but not necessarily the views of the agency within government that commissioned that work? I mean, government commissions studies all the time, and contractors with all sorts of views come to the fore, and sometimes the government will accept something and sometimes not. And sometimes there'll be a split, and you'll have a main assessment and then a minority report. So yes, there are questions, of course, about where Eric Davis's comments about off-world vehicles sit on that spectrum. But I think it's pretty clear what he's trying to get across, hinting pretty much. Now, look, the thing with the metamaterials is that it's pretty binary. There are some almost high school level chemistry tests, certainly college level, no more, that can quickly and easily determine whether something has been constructed on Earth or not. And I'm talking about isotopic ratio analysis. And the analogy that I always use is, if you're going to pay $10,000 for a big meteorite, you want to be darn sure it's a meteorite, not just a rock from someone's backyard. So
yes,
because the atmosphere here on Earth protects us from cosmic rays that are present in space, obviously there are some differences in isotopic ratios between terrestrial rocks and extraterrestrial rocks. Hence, you don't end up paying $10,000 for a rock. You actually get your genuine meteorite, or you walk away from the deal. So it's the same with these metamaterials. It's such an obvious test. Any chemist will tell you on day one, well, did they do isotopic ratio analysis with this? And that will answer a simple yes, no, whether it was made here or not. And other techniques to do with the structure of molecules, like X-ray diffraction tests, will, again, very quickly tell you whether you're dealing with something, you know, interesting but terrestrial, or something over and above. So when these people talk about metamaterials but then double down on it and sort of say, and this hasn't gone away, and of course, one of the other things that you'll recall, it's an interesting part of this story, was that the one of the commands within the U.S. Army entered into a CRADA, a collaborative research agreement with to the Stars Academy of Arts and Science. And this is Tom DeLonge's group, of course, who have some of the ATIP people and say that they've got some metamaterials themselves. Why on earth is the U.S. Army entering into this collaborative research association if they're not at least interested enough to have a contractual relationship with these people? Because I guarantee you, if they're looking at these materials, they will have said on day one, well, where are your tests? And I assume that does include X-ray diffraction and isotopic ratio analysis, and one, I can't conceive that those tests wouldn't have been done. And so for the U.S. Army to continue and enter into that CRADA, at the very least, one must say the suspicion is that those tests produced results that didn't cause them to walk away and say, okay, we're done, we're through. But
exactly.
But yeah, we want to talk to you people. And that is highly suggestive.
It certainly is. I find it very interesting. There's so much out there that shows that this is being taken very seriously. The phenomena that we're taking seriously in terms of sightings, we now call unidentified aerial phenomena. The unit that investigates is the Advanced Aerial Threat Identification Program. Why can't we say UFOs? Why are we choosing these more oblique terms? I mean, Unidentified aerial, is that a strong wind? Advanced compare with whom? What's the problem with just talking about what we're talking about in plainer language, do you think?
Two problems. Firstly, it's just simply the pop culture baggage that the term UFO has. And that's why we didn't invent the term UAP, but in the Ministry of Defense in the 90s, we deliberately adopted it, not for the media and the public, but for our internal policy discussions to get what I guess you would call stakeholder buy-in from defense ministers, service chiefs, intelligence chiefs, to take a serious look at this. We weren't going to get that stakeholder buy-in if we went into the meetings talking about UFOs. So we had to reframe the debate, reset the conversation by reinventing the language. And any psychologist involved with things like interrogations and information warfare will tell you that there's an inextricable link between thinking and language. Let me give you a classic example. Is in an employment dispute between management and the unions. Well, if you get the statement out and it said the unions rejected management's offer, it sounds like a neutral statement. And on the one hand, it is. But what you're doing is you're using two words, offer and rejected. And one of them is a positive word. Management made an offer, but the unions did a negative thing. They rejected it. And how many times do you maybe come across things like that and you don't give it a second thought, but people involved in shaping perceptions and opinions, I'm talking about government people, influencing people through, they know all about this. They do it all the time. And eventually it becomes instinctual to them. And so part of this UFO versus UAP is deliberate, but part of it is just because government people always like to beat around the bush and use acronyms and fancy words anyway. And if they can get away with 50 words when three would do, they'll go down that road. And you're probably thinking, as are people listening to this interview, yeah, and Nick's doing it too. Well, maybe. I can't escape my past. I mean, it's who I am. But I'm just saying that, John Alexander, of course, did the same thing when he was doing this with his advanced theoretical physics research group. It's just second nature.
Yes.
It also, there's one other factor. Does maybe make it slightly difficult, more difficult for people to go after this sort of thing with Freedom of Information Act requests. Have you got anything on UFOs? No, we haven't. Well, we've got a whole bunch of stuff on advanced theoretical physics research. Oh, well, okay, I guess that doesn't count.
Yes, that's very good. You mentioned earlier about briefing movie makers, and something a lot of people wonder is how much information versus disinformation might they be seeing in the movies? Have we been fed stuff to make sure that there's a bit of a giggle factor in the whole area of ET contact or ufology? Or do some movies actually have some real solid information, not just about how governments would respond, but about what we'd be responding to?
Some movies do have good information in them, and if without this, I hope this doesn't sound too arrogant, but of course if I get brought in as a consultant, I always hope that I do bring some realism to things. But setting that aside, no, contrary to some of the theories about this, government isn't trying to shape public perceptions through Hollywood. Hollywood is very much its own master when it comes to this. And look, I mean, if this was a part of a government acclimatization program or indoctrination program, perception management, whatever you want to call it, I think you would see a generally consistent message, but you don't. You see some movies going one way and some another. So sometimes you get Independence Day or War of the Worlds. Other times you get Close Encounters or E.T. So it would be a funny sort of information management campaign that pulled in two diametrically opposed directions like that. It's simply not the way it works. No, I mean, when you see these movies and when you see alien invasion movies, for example, it's just the old adage, fear sells. And if you can put in some big explosions and spaceships and lasers and things like that, it's just Hollywood doing what Hollywood does. It's not the hidden hand of government sitting behind feeding things in, even in a subtle way. That's not to say that there isn't perception management at one level. And what I will say is that whether it's the Ministry of Defense or the Department of Defense in the US, we often get asked, not just on UFOs, on a whole range of things, old Second World War movies, for example, we often get asked for help in making movies, sometimes with personnel, sometimes with equipment, sometimes with military bases. And we usually like to say yes. And the only thing that we generally do insist on is that if the US or the UK military is to be portrayed in a movie, we want those people, the men and women involved, to be portrayed as brave, resourceful, resilient, all sorts of things that we believe that we are. So generally, if a filmmaker comes to us and says, we're doing a new James Bond film, can we borrow a Navy ship? We say, yeah, as long as our people, you know, are strong and brave and true, and even if they go down fighting and saluting and what have you. So I know we've gone slightly off topic, but I just throw that in perhaps to illustrate the one way on those UFO movies where we do cooperate, the one thing that we do generally ask is that we are portrayed in a favorable light. And you know, it's not too much to ask if you're gonna help them out in that way. You don't want a script that makes you out to be the bad guy.
Sure, that makes perfect sense. You mentioned there the notion that fear sells, and certainly in terms of movie making, that's the case. In terms of getting government engagement, I guess there's a truth to that as well, because we have the Advanced Aerial Threat Investigation Program. We don't have the Advanced Civilizations Collaboration Program. And presumably that's to do with getting buy-in and getting serious engagement with it at a government level. But do you think that skews our approach to potential contact with our neighbors, that it's fear-based?
Yes and yes. I mean, absolutely, it's 100% correct. The reason we use words like threat in this is to get that buy-in, whether it's Senate Intelligence Committee, Armed Forces Committee, whatever it is, Armed Services Committee, pardon me, whatever it is, you are not going to get funding for research on this. Well, you might, but you'll get more funding if you play up the threat aspect. And if you throw Russia and China into the equation. And so you say, look, we've got this going on in our airspace. We don't know what it is. Might be Russia, might be China, might be something else. If it's Russia or China, we're in big trouble because they've made a quantum leap technological advance. If it's something else, well, sure as heck, we need to know about that too.
If we thought for 1 minute that the tic-tac UFOs of 2004 were Russia or China, wouldn't the response to them have been rather different?
It might have been, but then again, without wanting to go too far down this road, one of the things that you are aware whenever you're putting anything out is that you're not just putting it in front of the American people, you're putting it in front of everyone. So one of the questions with all these statements being made about UFOs at the moment, whether it's the Tic Tac or anything else, is how is this being viewed by political leadership in Moscow and Beijing? So that's always there in your awareness for sure. But, you know, yeah, it might have been handled different. But as I say, if this is some sort of intelligence operation, then you have to ask yourself, well, what's the message and what's the audience?
Sure. My own way into this whole topic has been very different to yours. I've come into this topic through the study of ancient mythologies and world ancestral narratives. And as I've researched those, it's funny, we mentioned abductions earlier, and that's a bit more of a hot potato in terms of public conversation. And as I did my research in mythologies, I found, oh, I actually can't avoid that. That is a huge strand in world mythology from cultures all around the world. And so in my recent writing, I've had to engage with that. And another thing that I found I had to engage with was the idea of underwater bases, again, from ancient mythologies. And I wonder if you've seen any data that has convinced you there's something interesting to be looking at in terms of underwater bases. I think one of the films released by the Pentagon from 2004 relates to possible underwater bases.
Well, the whole fact that the emphasis in recent years has shifted from the Air Force to the Navy, it is certainly interesting. And when Luis Elizondo talked about what he called the five observables of these UAP, one of his five observables was what he terms transmedium travel, this ability to seamlessly travel both underwater and in the atmosphere. And one, certainly when you listen to the testimony of some of the pilots involved in these US Navy UAP interactions, they talk about seeing something under the water. When you look at some of the other videos that have surfaced in recent years, I think there was one from Puerto Rico, actually, that I recall, 2015, I think it was actually a Homeland Security aircraft. I don't have it in front of me, but again, it's something very interesting, and yes, it commands our attention. Now, one could say one shouldn't forget that we already have that technology. People say, oh, that must be alien. Well, you know, people need to bear in mind that we've had, obviously, submarine-launched ballistic missiles for years. And so you have something, and that's a very good example of something that travels both underwater and in the air. So we shouldn't get too hooked on saying that transmedium travel is something that must be alien, because not at all. We can do that. Now, the question is, can we do it as well? And into that, one then has to factor that there are things out there, our own things, that won't be publicly declared for 10, 15, 20 years. Black projects, deeply classified, highly compartmentalized, all that sort of thing. So yeah, but this underwater thing is interesting, and though the mythology of it, look, I'm a regular contributor to shows like Ancient Aliens. I confess that religion, mythology, superstition, legend, belief, however you categorize all this vast body of knowledge that we have, it's not really my specialist field, but sure, there's no getting away from the fact that many, many different accounts from different cultures all around the world have talked about interaction between what are portrayed as gods or devils or angels or demons and people. And so those interactions are a constant theme. the idea of gods coming from the sky, but sometimes from under the water too, is again a feature. And the idea of people being, I'll use the phrase, sort of forcibly taken by the gods up into the skies, sometimes to show them things. But you can find it in the Bible. You can find it in ancient myths and legends, and you can find it in the modern UFO and alien abduction literature. Are we looking at the same phenomenon, simply viewed through the different lenses of culture, knowledge, and belief system? Maybe.
I want to see if I can get you to speculate for a moment on this. I am just old enough to remember the first moon landing in 1969, and we had six manned missions to the moon in the Apollo program. And it's now been a half century since then, and we still haven't got to Mars. What's the reason behind the pause? Has it been purely to do with money and politics, or is there an element of needing to manage what we might find on Mars or who we might meet on the way and on the way back? What's your theory behind this really unlikely 50-year pause in our spacefaring story?
Well, I'm not sure it is that unlikely. I mean, the just the sheer distances involved. I mean, putting it into context, the moon is about, 250,000 miles from the Earth. Mars, though of course the distance varies hugely because of its orbit around the sun, but even at its closest approach, it's I don't have it in front of me, and it's not my area of expertise, but it's 35 million miles or something like that. I mean, my point is that people sometimes say, oh, well, first the moon, then Mars, as if it's two stepping stones, but it's not two stepping stones. It's one stepping stone and one huge long abyss, a gap. And in a situation where, because of the distances involved, we're still at a point where pretty much 50% of every probe, half of all probes that we've sent to Mars have not made it. They've burned up, they've crashed, whatever. So before we send people there, we have to be very, very sure. And frankly, we're not yet. So I've heard people say, oh, we were warned off the moon, that's why we haven't gone back. We've been warned off Mars. And of course, we started it. I guess this is where we came in this interview with Chaim Eshed and his claims. So I mean, I don't rule any of this out, but I don't see any empirical evidence to support it yet.
Yes. I've heard a couple of Apollo astronauts sounding a bit mournful about slow progress in this direction, and what you're saying is absolutely practical and right. I guess we just might have hoped to have seen a little bit more action, and I also wonder what tech we might have that we've not yet deployed. We are still using the same technology, aren't we, that we were 50 years ago to get off the planet, you know, rocket power. And in a way that seems unlikely, but that is still what we're doing, isn't it?
It is. Now, some people, of course, say that somewhere in government, people have, maybe either through recovered extraterrestrial technology or whatever it is, have things like anti-gravity drives and such like, and it's just, you know, it's not being made generally available to people like NASA, who are still having to do the old-fashioned rocket stuff. I'm not convinced, and I think that if that tech was possible, you'd see people like Elon Musk and Yuri Milner and Richard Branson using it and developing it. And generally, one could say that the private sector, particularly now, tends to be ahead of government in these sorts of things. That said, it is telling that if you look, I referred earlier to that letter that the DIA sent to Congress just a few weeks after the New York Times broke the story of ATIP. If you look at the list of 38 studies, they do indeed contain things like anti-gravity, invisibility, stargates, warp drive, wormholes. Now, to me, though, this was more, yeah, we're trying to figure out how this would work. Blue Book was a program that said, let's take UFO sightings and figure out what they are. I think ATIP, arguably, was a program that said, let's take as our start point that this is real and ask ourselves what technologies viable interstellar travel would involve and how close we are to developing them. But I don't think we have developed them, because I think, firstly, if we had developed them, we wouldn't be studying them. We wouldn't be trying to figure them out. We already have done that. Yes, I get that there's left hand, right hand. And yes, I get that sometimes it's a double bluff and you might want people to think you're working on something that you've already, in fact, developed. But this is why I say you could argue yourself around in circles on this. Sometimes in the world of intelligence, you try to hide a program and a capability that you have, and you try to talk up and sometimes even invent a capability that you don't have. And I mean, it's difficult enough for people like me that have worked in that world. It's nigh on impossible for people outside that universe to try and come to terms with it. I mean, it is why we call this thing sometimes Hall of Mirrors.
Indeed. I remember about 10 years ago, the Royal Society held some discussions with regard to the cultural implications of contact with other civilizations. And it was just a year before, I think, that the Pope Benedict XVI had called on the Pontifical Academy of Sciences to convene its colloquium to talk about the implication, the theological implications of contact with other civilizations. And when those things were happening, certainly listening to the language of the spokespeople who presented to the media after that, there really seemed to be a sense of urgency about these discussions, certainly on the Vatican side, to getting people ready for the idea of living in a populated universe and having some company. And at the time, I wondered, where has this come from out of the blue? Why is there this urgency in the language they're using? And I wondered if at that time, those bodies were expecting some kind of a disclosure from another authority, whether from the Indian Space Program or the Chinese. I wonder if you have any insight as to what was going on at the time that really brought that conversation forward in that way.
Well, I do have some insight. Actually, I was present at both those Royal Society meetings. One was a one-day discussion meeting in London, and the second was a two-day seminar out in the country. And I would say that on the religion side, it goes back to a statement that I think the then director of the Vatican Observatory, who at the time I think was Gabriel Fuentes.
Yes.
He gave an interview in, I think it was March 2008, where he said there is no doctrinal objection to the existence of extraterrestrial life because, as he put it, man may place no creative limits upon God. Now, in my knowledge of the hierarchy of the Catholic Church, there's no way that he would have made that statement without ensuring that he had top cover from the Pope on such an impactful, profound statement. But then fast forward 2 years to these Royal Society discussion meetings. The first one was called The Detection of Extraterrestrial Life and the Consequences for Science and Society. And the second one was called Towards a Societal Agenda on Extraterrestrial Life. And as I say, I attended both of these meetings. I actually covered them for the media. I think I wrote a story for The Sun on the first one, and I think I wrote a story for NBC's technology and science site on the second, but I can't quite remember. Anyway, the point was, it won't surprise you to learn that the biggest row at any of these meetings was the row over the religious implications of all this. And this is a whole separate show in its own right. So I'm only going to scratch the surface on it. But of course, the conflict between science and religion is a well-known one that has a sort of long and dark backstory. And yes. Tempers were frayed. Voices were raised and tempers were frayed. Does any of this mean that these people know something is coming? I don't know. Does it mean they suspect it's coming and they're trying to cover the bases? Absolutely. Going back to the Catholic Church, no organization that has endured for 2,000 years is stupid. I mean, these are some very astute people. And it doesn't surprise me that they're trying to maybe position themselves so that if this suddenly and unexpectedly comes, whether it's an event or whether it's a governmental confirmation, that they won't be caught out and that they'll be able to say, well, yes, we have a policy on this. We've always believed that if extraterrestrial life is discovered, all that it shows is that the magnificence and expanse of God's creation is even bigger than people thought. And that's the line that they will use. Absolutely. Now, going back to pushback from, I know we're leaping around a bit here, but it's an important point. One of the pushbacks that certainly people like Chris Mellon and Lou Elizondo had come across in the Pentagon was a sort of fairly fundamentalist Christian belief that some aspects of the UFO phenomenon might be demonic. And of course, there's that passage in Ephesians chapter 2, verse 2, I believe, that uses in relation to Satan the phrase, the prince of the power of the air. And this is a phrase that has inspired some fairly fundamental Christians in the United States, in the United Kingdom too, to say we shouldn't be looking at and certainly not engaging with the UFO phenomenon because it's demonic, and engaging with it gives energy and power and legitimacy to it. And that's a whole nother aspect of this, which it's not often discussed in the media, but it's there. Mm-hmm. It's there as a factor for sure.
And I do hear a fair bit from that sort of community in response to the work I'm doing. It's just one, for instance, of how this topic intersects with some very, very old stories of human culture. But Nick, I love how grounded you are in this. You are such a valuable voice in this field because you are so grounded, you are so encyclopedic in your awareness of these things. And I think the way you talk about these things really invites a far wider demographic into the conversation. We could talk all day, but we will pause for this particular conversation. Before we do, though, I want to ask what you're doing right now and how we can keep up with the work that you're doing.
Well, I'm working, thank you for your kind remarks, by the way, but yeah, I'm working on a wide range of projects, some existing and some new television projects that, generally speaking, I can't really talk about until these things are announced. But even in these challenging days of COVID-19, albeit carefully, but the film and TV industry is carrying on. And I've been doing some filming over the last few weeks and months, and expect to do more in, in 2021. I'm also doing some journalism. I'm writing features myself and commenting on other people's stories to try and do my best, as you said in your remarks, trying to do my best to keep this subject in the public eye in a serious way and make sure that we do have a constructive and respectful debate about this across all spectrums of belief. And if I can play my part in that as a communicator, I'll continue to do so. I mean, hardly a day goes by without me getting an email or a call from a TV network or a newspaper wanting a quote on a story or something like that. And I'll continue to do that to try and help move this forward. And if I see something that I think's wrong, I'll call it out. And if I don't know, I'm not afraid. I think sometimes people in the UFO community are very often very dogmatic, whether they're skeptics or believers. Those of us who've looked at this from within government, we're not afraid actually to say sometimes we just don't know. And I'm not afraid to say I don't know, but I will continue to do what I can. And some of that is behind the scenes, but as much of it as possible is in the public eye. And I have a website, nickpope.net, but probably for day-to-day comment and engagement, whether I'm promoting a particular story that has caught my eye or sort of publicizing something that I've done myself, it's usually my Twitter feed, which is at Nick Pope M-O-D. But again, there are links to my social media presence on my nickpope.net website, but Twitter is usually for a quick comment on a breaking story is where I'm to be found.
Great. Thanks for that. We'll put those links in the description below. It's been a real pleasure talking to you today, Nick, and thank you so much for joining us on the Fifth Kind TV.
Well, thank you. It's been great to be on the show, and we really have. I'm not just saying this. Your questions have kind of enabled us to have a discussion which has touched on some fairly deep specialist areas about the way in which government and military and intelligence community views this, which I don't always dive so deep into. So thank you.
Thank you for going there. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
The Fifth Kind. Thank you.